Indie Comics. Indie Comics.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Omen Revelations Podcast, the flagship show of the Omen Comics Podcast Network. I'm your host, Michael Nunley, and with me as always is my friend and co-host, Steve Sellers. For today's episode, Steve and I are going to talk about Stephen King's two main haunted hotel movies. Of course, we're talking about 2007's 1408, based on King's 1999 short story of the same name, and 1980's Kubrick classic, The Shining, based on Stephen King's 1977 novel of the same name. But before we get started, did you have any opening thoughts, Steve?
Sure, I can add a few things. Stephen King is a legendary writer who's been adapted numerous times, so I don't want to take anything away from him. Still, he's a writer who tends to descend into his own personal tropes a lot of the time. And while we will see some of these tropes in these two films, the main character is an alcoholic writer, psychic children, and so on. These movies are a bit different from his usual fare. And that's mainly because none of these stories are set in Maine, which very often tends to be the case with King stories. These are haunted hotel stories set well away from Maine. And that presents a nice change from the usual locations and characters that you often see in King's work. That's part of the reason why these stories as memorable as they are, I suspect. So with that out of the way, Mike, why don't we get started?
I would love to, Steve. So the first film we're going to dive into is the psychological horror film 1408. If you're looking for the story, it is the third tale in the audiobook collection Blood and Smoke, released in 1999. Also in 2002, 1408 was collected in written form as the 12th story in King's collection Everything's Eventual. The film stars the amazing John Cusack and Samuel L. Jackson, and it was directed by Michael Hafstrom. Now, I know that Steve and I are going to have a lot to say about this one, but did you have anything you wanted to say to start us off, Steve?
We've only just begun. Seriously, though, this was a film that was not on my radar until I was turned onto it by our good friend and DM, David Nemesis Howard. Nemesis is a guy who knows his horror, and if you want more of his insight into the genre, he co-hosts the Countless Corpses podcast with Mike. Check it out. Definitely check those episodes out. Anyway, at the time that this movie came out, I wasn't that into horror, so it just kind of passed me by. Anyway, 1408 came up as a film that Nem and I decided that we should discuss on another show around last year, so I finally gave it a look. I was pleasantly surprised by it in a lot of ways, but we'll talk about that as we go. So, Mike, why don't we talk about what 1408 is and who our main character is?
Sounds like a great idea. Mike Anslin is a nonfiction writer that works on a series of books entitled 10 Nights and 10 Haunted Various Things, where he goes to supposedly haunted locations like haunted houses, graveyards, and haunted castles. His latest project is 10 Haunted Hotels. His books are bestsellers, despite Mr. Olin telling him that they aren't any bargain bin at the bookstores in the film. But in truth, the person he is in his books does not reflect the author. In fact, I would go as far as to say that Mike Anslin in the books he writes is perhaps a persona. Mike not only doesn't believe in the paranormal or the supernatural, he doesn't really believe in anything. But nonetheless, he pretends to believe so that he can stay in these places and write his lucrative 10 Nights and 10 Haunted book series. But Anslin does feel some level of guilt at their success since he is a fraud. He does have his superstitions, though, like his lucky Hawaiian shirt that he wears in the movie but is not referred to as such, and of course his cigarette. According to the book, he quit smoking after his brother died of lung cancer, but he carries the cigarette, which must be stale as fuck by now, in his ear just in case of a nuclear bomb goes off. That way he can have one last cigarette before the world ends. But what about you, Steve? What's your perception on Mike Anslin?
At first, Anslin comes across as a self-absorbed jerk who thinks he's a bigger deal than he actually is. He's abrasive, he's cynical to the extreme, and he comes across as pretty arrogant in the early scenes of the film. He's not a particularly likable character early on, but that's the point. As the film goes on and the story confronts Anslin with his past, we start to see him grow out of that. We also understand why Anslin is like this, especially with the loss of his daughter and the way that his family broke apart. He's a man who's been beaten down by life, and he channels his pain and his grief into these haunted hotel books. Ostensibly, he's trying to debunk the supernatural, but what I think he's really doing is tearing down other people's faith to cope with his own personal trauma. He's a messed up guy, but it takes his journey to a literal hellscape to help him find closure. That makes Enslin a more interesting and sympathetic character to me, and I ended up caring a lot about him a lot more by the end.
I had not really considered the angle of wanting to tear down the faith of others to help him cope with the loss of his daughter and his family. I mean, basically, if others can be forced to see things like he does, he will be less alone and convinced of how right he is about God. I'm reminded of Mike Enslin's line, you know, what kind of God would do this to a little girl? The answer, at least according to Mike Enslin, is that only an evil God would do that. Either that or there is no God at all. But you're right. Mike does come off a bit like a conceited jerk in the beginning. By the end, I was definitely on Team Mike, though. But what do you say we start talking about the writing a little bit, Steve?
Sure. Stephen King tends to find influences for stories just about everywhere, and he tends to do his research pretty noticeably. We see that pretty clearly in the case of 1408. The initial story inspiration for 1408 came from a collection of real-life news stories about world-renowned parapsychologist Christopher Chacon's investigation of the most notoriously haunted hotel rooms in the world. In the U.S. alone, Chacon has investigated hundreds of haunted hotels from New York City to San Francisco, such as the Cecil Hotel in Los Angeles, Battery Carriage House in South Carolina, the Myrtles Plantation in Louisiana, and the Hotel del Coronado in Coronado in California. But the one we'll be talking about is a hotel in the San Antonio area, the Emily Morgan Hotel, and it's right along the Riverwalk if you've ever been there. Due to alleged paranormal activity, the Emily Morgan Hotel sealed one of their rooms, and conveniently, it was room 1408. You can find the place if you ever go downtown in San Antonio. It's a huge Gothic Revival building, and it looks surprisingly not that unlike the Dolphin Hotel in 1408. Back when I lived in Texas, I actually drove past the Emily Morgan a few times on trips to San Antonio, though I never knew it had a haunted history for a very long time. I just thought the building looked cool, and I just moved on with my day. But knowing that it was the basis for this movie makes me regret never having stopped there. So let me share a few details that King worked into the Dolphin Hotel that he lifted from the Emily Morgan Hotel. You know when Gerald Olin, the hotel manager, talks about how there's no official 13th floor in the Dolphin Hotel? The Emily Morgan Hotel didn't have one either. That's because there was an empty floor that they intended to use between the 13th floor and the observation tower, and they meant to put the clock in that floor. This didn't work out, but the convention stuck. The 14th floor of the building is the real 13th floor of the hotel. They kept that convention because the hotel managers thought it was less superstitious that way, and it probably wouldn't scare the guests as much. Not that it worked, because the 14th floor was reputed to be haunted. Before it was converted to a hotel, the 14th floor was used as a waiting area for a hospital. Other floors were even used as a morgue. So presumably all the people who died there contributed to the haunted flavor of the building. King didn't really use that, as far as I know, but it gives some context to the hotel's reputation and how it worked into the story of 1408.
Wow. You know, I could definitely testify that waiting rooms are evil. That is actually pretty cool. I was under the impression that it was generically based on like haunted hotel stories and then, you know, spun together with a little Stephen King magic. But I like that it was at least based on an actual hotel. But speaking of what the story is based on, I believe you had a little bit to say about the actual book by King, didn't you, Steve?
Yeah, I did. The story on which this film was based was almost never written. Stephen King originally created the first few pages of 1408 for his nonfiction book On Writing as an example of how to revise a first draft. And as an aside, I recommend that book if you're interested in the craft of writing. It is a very good starting point to work from. The story of 1408, however, intrigued King, and he wound up not only finishing a complete draft, but he adapted it for an audiobook compilation of short stories. The screenplay for 1408 originally had more lines and detail than the end result film. For example, Kevin O'Malley begs Mike to fix it, sewing his throat back together while chasing through the air duct. And the 1950s heavyset woman who jumped out of a hotel window not only cries, but she also says, "May Jesus forgive me and fuck you, Henry Smith." Mike also tries to hug his elderly father in the hotel bathroom, but he discovers that he's actually hugging the hotel toilet when he opens his eyes. Katie Enslin's name in the screenplay is actually written as Gracie Enslin instead. So I guess they decided on the final name later. And also, as we'll discuss later, there were different alternate endings used in the film. Still, I have to admit that I never read the original story. So can you add some details about that, Mike?
I sure can, Steve. So I would like to do a little comparison between the book and the film here, if I could. There is a similar meeting with Mr. Olin in the book and the film where he discloses the room's morbid history. But some of the facts are changed, I'm guessing, to up the stakes, I imagine. But Olin reveals that due to the superstitious practice of never recognizing the 13th floor, the room listed as being on the 14th. But because it is on the 13th floor, the room is actually cursed, and all the more so because its numbers add up to 13. But like in the film, Enslin is actually a skeptic about the paranormal. But in the book, Mr. Olin believes that his skepticism might actually make him more susceptible to the room's powers and pleads with him to reconsider staying in the room. In the book, there have been a total of 42 deaths in 1408. 12 of them were from suicides and an additional 30 natural deaths over the span of the Dolphin's 68 years. In the film, however, there are 56 deaths and not 42, and there are only 22 natural deaths and not 30. As far as the types of deaths, there are 7 jumpers and 5 hangings, Mr. Olin mentions, that account for the 12 suicides listed in the book, and one more cause of death, including 4 overdoses. But all of that only accounts for 38 of the 56 deaths Mr. Olin says happened in the room. We are left to speculate how the other 18 of them died. Mr. Olin also changes how long the hotel has been around, saying that it's been around for 95 years and not 68. Mr. Olin says that he does not believe that there are ghosts in 1408, but that something does reside in the room that causes terrible things to happen to anyone who's in there for more than a few minutes. I prefer his line, "It's an evil fucking room." But either way, for that reason, he did his best to keep 1408 vacant during his 20 years as the Dolphins manager. But after the 4th death on his watch, he has forbidden anyone from renting 1408. Do you have any thoughts on those changes, Steve?
Nothing too deep on this one, I'm afraid. I don't know why they changed the statistics on the deaths in the room, and I'm not sure it really changes very much in the scheme of things. So I'm honestly fine with all that. I can say that neither the book nor the movie drew the details of the deaths out in the room from anything that happened in the Emily Morgan Hotel. In fact, the 7th floor had more of a grisly reputation than the 14th floor, as that was the one that was used as a morgue. I did really love the "evil fucking room" line, and Samuel L. Jackson delivers it perfectly. I don't know what it is about Samuel L. Jackson, but he's just so good when he's dropping F-bombs. I mean, yeah, so I don't know how much of it is that the screenwriter's adding the line in, and how much of it is that Samuel L. Jackson drops the F-bomb like a boss, but it's a memorable line that sticks with you. But I think there was another change you wanted to get into, Mike?
There is, actually. In the book, Mike Enslin's problems with the room start before he even enters it. When he first looks at the room, the door appears to be tilted to the left. Then he looks away and he looks back and the door is normal. But then he looks up at it again and the door is tilted to the right. Enslin, however, just like in the movie, explains it all away as the power of suggestion and Mr. Olin's manipulations. So he girds himself and goes into the room. Now, in the movie, the room starts messing with Mike all the way down in the lobby with the woman and her infant child. He sees them again entering 1410 when he's approaching 1408. The woman, of course, turns out to be his wife, Lily Enslin, and their daughter, Katie.
I was reminded a little bit of The Shining, actually, now that you mention it, where Danny gets visions of the creepy ghost twins before the Torrance family officially moves into the Overlook Hotel. And we'll talk about them when we get to The Shining, more than likely. But I was thinking that the filmmakers wanted a similar effect by teasing the ghosts and then pulling the twist of having it be Lily and Katie. But that's purely a guess on my part. Anyway, let me bring up another creepy moment that you might find interesting, Mike. So while Mike Enslin walks down the corridor of the 14th floor heading to room 1408, the camera cuts to a tray that is left out on the corridor floor in front of a room, having leftovers from a sandwich and fries. When the hotel operator calls Mike after the window injures his hand, she tells him that there's going to be a delay bringing him a sandwich and offers the option to get a side dish instead of French fries. This is more proof that the room has powers outside of itself, and they've clearly started messing with Mike before he's even crossed the threshold.
Wow. That is really one of those, like, blink and you'll miss it kind of things. I'll have to admit that I didn't notice that. That's a good catch. I will add that it is interesting that a posh hotel like the Dolphin would have flies on the food in the hallway that you mentioned, and cockroaches in their air vents, for that matter. I will get into this in more detail, but that does remind me of a certain Lord of Hell. I'll just plant that seed and move on. In the movie, Mr. Olin tells Mike that they only go into the room once per month, and they only stay for 10 minutes. But even then, a maid found herself locked in the bathroom of 1408 for a few minutes, and when they got her out, she had taken out her eyes with a pair of scissors and was laughing hysterically. We have to assume that she was one of the mutilations they talked about. But back to the book. Mike spends 70 minutes checking out the room and recording the experience on his tape recorder, and right away he starts seeing things. It seems like there was a much shorter time in the movie checking out things, and while he does start to see things, it is not until later that it gets as severe as it does in the book. But Ensslin does make the same connection about likening the experience to taking bad dope, but I think that is old-timer slang for taking acid. Like Ensslin says in the movie, he dosed me. But to give you an idea of what kind of things he was seeing, the breakfast menu on the nightstand changes languages from English to French, then Russian, then Italian, and then into a woodcut of a wolf eating a screaming boy's leg. The pattern on the wall seems to shift and warp, and the pictures on the wall have shifted into frightening visions. A still life of an orange becomes Ensslin's severed head. Ensslin sees pictures disappearing and reappearing. Ensslin's feet sink into the carpet like quicksand. Paintings come alive and more. It is just intense, crazy shit. And Ensslin's thoughts become more and more bizarre and incoherent as it's happening. He tries to make a phone call, but only hears a nightmarish voice on the other end of the line, chanting bizarre phrases. For example, this is 9, 9. This is 9, 9. This is 10, 10. We have killed your friends. Every friend is now dead. This is 6, 6. My guess is that 9, 10, and 6 were among the 12 suicides in the book. Of course, this happens later in the movie, too, but the numbers are changed to 5 to 8, which coincidentally add up to 13.
Of course. Now, I admit that I was spit thrown with the whole your friends are dead sequence, especially since none of Denzel's friends actually die in the movie. So having it be a reference to the various suicides in the room makes much more sense and gives some helpful context there. I will say that Ensslin probably should have started running by this point, but he's so arrogant and driven to prove his skepticism to be right that he doesn't leave until it's way too late for him. Around this point, he might have gotten out, but his own character flaws lead him straight to the trap, and I love that. But I think there are more changes you wanted to mention, Mike.
There are definitely more changes I want to discuss, but first, I need to address your comment about Mike Ensslin's arrogance. I think it certainly could have been arrogance, but I personally saw it a little differently. When you're fighting a stronger opponent, oftentimes you got to dig deep and embrace the challenge, you know? Use the pain and the blood to make yourself strong enough to fight through it in spite of the pain. I mean, if you haven't been there in a fight, I don't know that that makes any sense. But it's very focusing, and it's something akin to an absolute refusal to lose. I think you see this in Ben Grimm a lot. You know, he digs down and fights his way through. We've talked about that's how he's able to, like, stand up against the Hulk. You know, you also see that moment in Wonder Woman or Wolverine when they get that grin after being hurt. That's the all right, motherfucker moment. That is where I saw Mike Ensslin. The harder the room pushed, the deeper he dug. He was not going to lose this fight. Mike did come there to prove that 1408 was bullshit, and my impression was that the deeper he dove, the more resolve he had. I'm thinking of two lines from him specifically, the first being, we came here to get the story, and we don't rattle, do we? And the message he left on his tape recorder before he climbed out onto the ledge of the room was that the room didn't win. What do you think of that, Steve?
That is an interesting way to look at it, and it is certainly possible. Mike Ensslin has a definite competitive streak to him, looking at the debunking of the hauntings as almost like a game. He probably also feels like he's competing with Olin after that meeting with him in the office. But I do think there is an arrogance to him just because of all the hotels he's debunked over the years. He feels like it's a game and that he's gotten very good at, and he hates losing. He plays to win at any cost, which is what he ends up having to do to defeat the room. But why don't we get into other changes from the book, Mike?
Sure, Steve. The whole thing with Katie is almost non-existent in the book, and it's really only referred to. In fact, the movie draws out the whole experience in the room considerably, because in the book, it was not long after Anselm started seeing all the stuff and losing his mind that the room itself started to melt. The walls and the ceiling began warping, and Anselm senses an evil, dangerous, otherworldly presence of some sort coming for him. My guess is that it is the demon bound to 1408, desperate to get out and away from this thing coming for him. Mike sets his lucky Hawaiian shirt on fire while he's still wearing it. Somehow this breaks the spell of the room, long enough for Mike Anselm to stumble out into the hallway while another guest tries to put out his shirt by throwing a bucket of ice on him. The guest walks over to the room and looks in it, but Mike warns him not to go in there because the room is haunted and the door slams shut. The theatrical cut of the film actually ends fairly close to this. Michael sets the room on fire. Firemen are able to break in and get him out of there. And just like in the book, Michael warns the firemen not to go in there, but says that it's because it's an evil room.
This definitely alludes to Anselm's character journey throughout the film. He goes from someone who's convinced that everything's a hoax into accepting that a room can, in fact, be evil. And he even discards the shirt, which represents a personal sense of superstition. Although I will add that Anselm takes the Harry Malcolm approach to dealing with evil hotels, and it's great.
I had totally forgotten about that. For our listeners, Steve and I are part of a Call of Cthulhu RPG group, and we were actually in the kind of evil hotel, and Steve's character Harry Malcolm totally suggested that we burn it down. It was a really fun moment, but back to the film. I really like the idea of burning it down. You know, in many beliefs from around the world, fire is a purifier and the ultimate destroyer. It is no coincidence that fire is in hell. As far as Mike's character journey, you are absolutely right. He has done a complete 180 since he came to the hotel, and that moment captures that perfectly. But if we could move on, I'd like to talk about one of my favorite things about 1408, and that is that there is no doubt that everything that goes on inside the room is absolutely real, and Michael Anselm is not imagining it. I like this because he was an unbeliever. It's similar to how I feel about Reed Richards being confronted with undeniable proof of magic. And in Anselm's case, I think the playbacks on his tape recorder absolutely prove that what happened was real beyond a shadow of a doubt. But Mike goes into the whole situation both out to prove there is no God or afterlife, and as if the room 1408 had actually challenged him to prove it's not real with the postcard that Mike received. Do not enter 1408, or at least that's the theory I like. Basically, because Mr. Olin had forbidden customers from renting the room became desperate for a victim and sent out the postcard. The other theory that I think actually makes less sense, but it could work, is that after 20 years and 4 deaths, Mr. Orlin wanted someone to finally destroy the room because he personally could not do it. But what do you think about that, Steve? Who sent that postcard and why?
Well, let me get into a possible theory and get your take on it. Though to be fair, it probably only works with one of the alternate endings, but that's enough to at least throw it out there. The thought that I'd had since nearly the beginning is that Mike Anselm is already dead by this point, and in fact that he's been dead ever since the surfing accident. It's kind of like a Sixth Sense situation where he's dead and he doesn't seem to be aware of it. So everything he's seeing since then is this weird afterlife journey, and it's hell itself, or at least the demon in 1408 that invited him to that room. But it only is even plausible with the ending where Lily and Mike's publisher are going through the house in LA, and even then you have to explain a couple of things to make it work.
That is certainly a possible theory. I have heard many surfers having a wave crash down on them, and the mixture of the continually arriving waves and the circulating current underneath can actually keep you trapped underwater. It certainly looks like that was what was happening to Mike. And it is a little weird that he would just wind up on the beach flat on his back after that, you know, with the water just escaping his lungs without assistance. So while I personally don't think that is what happened, it does seem to be proposed as a possibility by the movie.
I mean, it definitely is one of those things that is not necessarily proven, and you have to do the work of the movie to make it work. But discounting that, I do like the idea that Olin is the one who sent the postcard, and he was using reverse psychology to convince Anselm to destroy the room. The whole song and dance at the beginning in that case is that it's a mind game to play on Anselm's ego and test his resolve. That's certainly a plausible idea, given how he seems appreciative of Anselm and his burning of the room in the end scenes. Like, he's gained respect for him after doing what Olin himself wasn't able to, probably because the owners of the hotel wouldn't allow him to do anything so drastic as burning it down.
Hmm. I could certainly see that now that you put it that way. Actually, I'm a little torn now. If I'm honest, I like both theories. And I have a hard time picking now that Mr. Olin's theory makes more sense. But if I could switch gears here for a minute, I would like to talk about two somewhat casually stated things from Mike Ensslin. The first is that Ensslin said some smartass spoke of the banality of evil. If that's so, then we've entered into the seventh ring of hell. Those are two pretty big references there. And I believe you had a fair amount to share about the whole banality of evil thing and the circles of hell references, didn't you, Steve?
Sure. Stephen King seems to be interested in the banality of evil as a concept. I suspect this idea played some role in his creation of Randall Flagg as the villain of the Stand in the Dark Tower series, because Flagg is the embodiment of evil in the Stephen King universe. King has said regarding Flagg that he's uncomfortable with the idea of evil, but that he wanted to embody the notion of people at their worst. I think a similar process came into his mind in the way that he defined the room. But for now, let's get into what we mean by the banality of evil. In Eichmann in Jerusalem, a report on the banality of evil, Hannah Arendt insisted that only good had any depth. Good can be radical, but evil can never be radical. It can only be extreme, for it possesses neither depth nor any demonic dimension yet, and this is its horror. It can spread like a fungus over the surface of the earth and lay waste the entire world. Evil comes from a failure to think. It defies thought, for as soon as thought tries to engage itself with evil and examine the premises and principles from which it originates, it is frustrated because it finds nothing there. That is the banality of evil. Stephen King seems to regard evil as the horrible things that people do each other without thought or caring. So that seems to fit into Hannah Arendt's thoughts there. We see this in The Shining as well, where Jack hurts his son in a thoughtless way because he was consumed with blind, unreasonably reasoning anger about something that Danny had done. To bring it back to 1408, I think he was saying that the paintings on the wall were completely unoriginal and were even painted the same way as it has always done, completely unoriginal and uninspiring, though one of the paintings did have an air of menace to it. As he didn't like the paintings, I'm guessing that that's why he chose the banality of evil reference. I have to assume then that the particular reference was a joke on Eslin's part, and he didn't know yet just how evil the paintings could be at that point. But that all leads interestingly into the seventh circle of hell comment. Early in his stay in the haunted room, Mike Ensslin humorously compares it to the seventh circle of hell. In the Inferno section of the Divine Comedy, the seventh circle of hell, which is also called the hell of the violent and the bestial, is described in cantos 12 through 17 of Dante Alighieri's Inferno. It includes three rounds of sins of violence: the violence against neighbors, the violence against themselves, and the violence against God, nature and art. Still, it is the art aspect that Mike Ensslin refers to with that line. The souls there have rejected, respectively, God, nature, and art, but other rings are relevant as well as they come up. The first ring of the seventh circle is a river of boiling blood and fire, reserved for murderers, war makers, plunderers, and tyrants. This is why the room is so hot when he gets there. The second ring of this circle is the wood of the suicides, which is reserved for both those who killed themselves and those who attempted suicide. The souls trapped there personify self-hatred. In the film, many of the occupants of the haunted room have indeed committed suicide. The third ring of the circle is the plain of burning sand, which is reserved for blasphemers, sodomites, and usurers. Mike Ensslin is definitely a blasphemer, as he flat out says that there is no God. He rejects God after his daughter dies, and that leads him into a much darker place. So Dante's ninth and final circle of hell is reserved for the worst of the sinners. In this last circle, the very center of the Inferno, Dante plays as those guilty of treachery and betrayal towards loved ones, close friends, country, and their masters. It is also the furthest from God's light and warmth, and is therefore the coldest and darkest region of hell, which is why the room is freezing when Mike Ensslin finally reaches it. It could be argued that Ensslin could be seen that way because he turns his back on his wife and his father after the death of Katie. It could be that the room interprets that as a betrayal of loved ones and of kin. Ensslin is later able to reconcile that, and the room becomes warmer after he does so. But at that moment, he is far from God's warmth.
Wow. That's pretty interesting. You know, Mike was definitely someone who hated himself. He hated himself as a father, a husband, a man, and a writer. While it does not show it, I would not be surprised if Mike had at least attempted suicide. You know, in the director's cut, he actually does commit suicide when he burns the room down. So the wood of suicides is definitely appropriate and might even be some foreshadowing, depending on which version of the film you watch. But I will talk more about that later. You know, I hadn't considered it before, but according to Yeshua, there is but one unforgivable sin, the blasphemy of the Holy Spirit, which is what Mike Ensslin did by both denying God's existence and rejecting his offer of salvation. It would seem that the plane of burning sands was quite appropriate as well.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And it's not just that he denied the existence of God, but that he tried to actively destroy the faith of others to assuage his own pain. That's a special kind of blasphemy, and at least in Dante's cosmology, deserving of a sentence to the plane of burning sands.
That does make it worse, and certainly guarantees the planes. So I can get behind that. But I would like to comment a little bit on the second ring of the seventh circle there. Mr. Olin says that nobody has ever lasted longer than an hour in the room, 1408. We found out watching the room that everything Ensslin went through only took an hour, and he had the choice to kill himself or relive that hour over and over again for eternity. The same choice all of the other guests were given, I'm assuming. I initially thought that this was merely meant that Mike would be checking out of there around 9 or 9:15 p.m. as the timer started around 8:07, I believe. But I realized now that there was a deeper element of terror there, and that time is almost irrelevant since that single hour would be repeated for eternity. We saw the people who committed suicide in 1408 reliving their hour over and over again while Mike was there. Granted, it's not exactly the same, but kind of like the second ring of the seventh circle that is reserved for those who have committed suicide. I noticed that even after the room was destroyed by fire, Mike was left behind at a place of his own suicide, done by burning down the room with him in it. But it does not appear to be a nightmare or a hellish place, and that makes me think three things. One, Mike's sacrifice freed the souls that were trapped in there. And two, this might be reaching a bit, but in the Divine Comedy, Dante goes through hell, and that is true. But then he also goes up to heaven at the end. Perhaps spending an eternity with his daughter was Mike's heaven. And number three, that the presence that was in the room is no longer there. I know that you think 1408 is hell itself, and there is certainly room for that theory on what we see in the film, and I'm not denying the validity of that at all. My theory is a bit of an offshoot of your theory, and that it is based on my belief that there was actually an evil entity, a dangerous presence possessing the room. Granted, this is heavily influenced by the short story by Stephen King and not necessarily the film. But my theory is that the room is connected to hell via the gates of hell, and that there is a demon or otherwise evil entity that opens up the various gates of hell depending on who comes into the room. There is a belief that there is a different gate for each set of mythological or religious beliefs. It is believed by some that what you take with you in your heart will determine the state of your afterlife. So if you've committed evil in your life, then you will suffer that same evil being done to you throughout eternity. Likewise, if you entered into an afterlife with good in your heart, then your afterlife would be a heaven of sorts, full of happiness. And something along those lines comes across in Dante's Inferno. The punishment fits the crime. And that seems to be the case in 1408. In Mike Ensslin's case, he brought a heavy heart full of pain, guilt, and unbelief, and those things were turned against him by the room. In thinking about this theory and knowing that Mike felt an evil and dangerous presence approaching him before he set the fire and got out of the room, my guess is that there is a demon attached to the room. Who is this demon? I think the presence of the room is by one of the builders of the gates of hell, likely Lucifer, Satan, Leviathan, or Lilith. At the very least, one of their subordinates. I'm thinking Beelzebub. He is the Lord of Hell and the Lord of Flies I was referring to earlier. I know that we viewed the film a little differently, and I think that like The Shining, there's enough questions left unanswered that there can be more than one legitimate take on what happens in the film. In the book, Mike says that he knows it was not ghosts that made him experience those things in the room because ghosts are merely humans, while whatever was in that room was horrifically inhuman. And that word, inhuman, perhaps influenced by The Conjuring, is why I think the room was possessed or controlled by a demon. But do you have any thoughts on that before I go on, Steve?
Some. In King's Mythos, the idea is that spirits can leave traces of themselves in a place, and it can be for good or ill. Dick Halloran goes into some detail on this in The Shining, so we can revisit that in more detail later when we get there. Anyway, it's certainly possible that all the accumulated negative energy from all the death and suffering in 1408 led to the room manifesting something truly evil, akin to a demon. You could be right that the evil force in the room could have been trapping the spirits who died there. We do see some of them stuck in their last moments, perhaps revisiting their last hour in the room over and over, much as Enslin himself does. Fire tends to be purifying, as we mentioned, so burning down the room could have cleansed it and allowed the trapped spirits to find peace. Or for Enslin himself to find his heaven with Katie, depending on which ending you want to go with. But I think you had more connections that you wanted to make with Dante, Mike?
There are just a couple things. In thinking about what you said there about the nine circles of hell and even the whole of the Divine Comedy, it seems there are definitely some similarities to Mike's journey. Mr. Olin is kind of like a Virgil in this story, like a guide. And with Beatrice being a symbol of divine love, this might be reaching here, but Katie could represent her in the film, especially when we see that Mike ends up with his daughter in eternity at the end of the film. In both the Divine Comedy and in 1408, Mike Enslin and Dante are warned multiple times not to go further into hell, or rather limbo, the first circle. But both of them, because of their own demons, if you will, or even sin, ignore these warnings and enter into hell of their own volition, or the room as it were. Abandon all hope, ye who enter here indeed.
Oh yeah, I was thinking something along those lines myself upon rewatching the film again, so that's a great catch. The story is about the descent into hell, walking through purgatory, and then rising up to heaven where Dante finds Beatrice. We definitely see a similar pattern as Enslin suffers in hell, exists in a state of purgatory as he cleanses himself of his sins, and then he's able to reach heaven with his daughter. I agree that Katie is definitely the Beatrice figure, as she represents a pure form of love. And Olin could certainly be seen as a Virgil figure guiding him into the room. But to paraphrase Morpheus, he can only show Enslin the door. He has to be the one who has to walk through it. So I think the parallels are there and they certainly fit. But I think you had something to bring up about the room.
I do, and this is one of the harsher moments in the film, at least to me. The room cuts Mike off from the rest of the world early on, something the Torrances experience in the Overlook Motel and The Shining that we'll be discussing next. Even when he throws that lamp out, it disappears before it hits the ground, right around the same place midway down the replay ghosts disappear. Then when he tries to go out the window and get to the room 1410, he finds that the room has been separated from the rest of the hotel. This is, of course, hammered in by the map of the hotel turning completely black except for his room. He tries to reach out to his wife via the internet, and she is cut off from him. Then he goes through the ducts in the ceiling and has to relive all the times he walked away when he should have stayed, and how he let his guilt and grief destroy not just his life, but also seriously hurt those that he loved, leaving him a faceless and morose man who believes in nothing. Then, despite having rejected the idea that God could even exist because of what happened to his daughter, he finally reaches out for the Bible saying, "You win. I'm finally going to reach out to you." And when he opens it up, all of the pages are blank.
I think this is the purgatory aspect of the room, and we definitely see a shift between pure torment and suffering instead with the idea of teaching Enslin a lesson. The pages are blank because that's all the Bible ever meant to him, nothing. They're blank pages because he has no faith in any of the words inside the book. They are meaningless in his eyes. The room is throwing his blasphemy back in his face, confronting him with his own empty cynicism. So I thought that was a really clever moment. If you only reach out to God when it benefits you at that moment, is it really faith at all? Does it really mean anything? The movie's saying that it doesn't, and it's both a good horror moment and a good thematic moment.
Wow. That is an amazing analysis of that scene, my friend. I'm impressed. That totally fits with the Divine Comedy thing that is going on in the film, and that is how I'm going to see it from now on. But I have what may or may not be another wacky theory for you, Steve. I think that the room intentionally dropped the window on Mike Enslin's hand to draw the blood out. We know that the room is something akin to a demon, so it may have been a rite of sorts based on Leviticus 17:11, which says that the life of the flesh is in the blood. I think that the room needed Mike's blood to tailor the nightmare to him. When that drop of blood hits the floor, the room absorbed it. But I can't help but notice that Mike puts his blood all over the room in a way that is similar to priestly rituals performed by the Levites and even Israel as a whole. When the angel of death came down to kill the firstborn sons of Egypt, the Israelites protected themselves by putting blood all around their doors. Levite priests would sprinkle blood onto the Ark of the Covenant. Mike Ensslin puts his blood all over the floor, sprinkled around with him with his dripping blood. He put it on the door by banging on it, showing that his blood is going on everything that he touches. Then he puts his blood on the windowsill when he was looking out across the street. Then he goes out onto the ledge and eventually rubs his blood on the walls themselves outside the room. You'll notice that this is when the room separates him from the rest of the hotel and everything else goes black. It's almost as if the demon room is guiding Mike Ensslin through a ritual. I know I've come up with some offbeat theories, as you have said, but I have to ask if this makes sense to you.
Actually, I can see what you're saying there. It could be some kind of blood ritual, or it could just be that the room needs to taste blood to really gain the power it needs over him. It could also be a fear thing, since the room starts to take power over Ensslin when it shows the ability to cause him physical pain. It might be that up to that point, the room had more trouble in affecting him because he didn't fear or respect it. But that act of first blood put the fear of God into Ensslin, and that's when the room really starts to get nasty. It could even be feeding on Ensslin's fear, becoming stronger the more frightened that he becomes. It's the Patrick O'Leary of evil rooms.
That is a good one. You know, in my personal opinion, this is just how I choose to look at things. Faith and fear are the opposite sides of a coin of perspective. Both are belief in something that we cannot see and hasn't happened yet. Just from a logical standpoint, it would make sense that if God requires faith to work, then the devil or demons would require fear to work. So I could totally get behind that. But I'm not done with my theories yet. And I have another one for you. And it actually ties in with what you're saying there. When Mike saw the guy across the street in the window, it turned out to be a reflection of himself. But one that was all blacked out. So you couldn't tell by looking at him that he was Mike Ensslin. Mike screams to him and begs him for help, but the shadow Mike only reflects him. Then the woman sneaks up behind the shadow Mike and attacks him. I can't help but notice that almost everything that happens in the room is the room turning Mike's guilt and fears against him so that he will kill himself. It would seem that this scene is an analogy of the hour Mike is about to experience.
Cool. So that definitely backs up the suspicion I had about the room feeding on fear. That's awesome. I also suspect that you're right about the room trying to drive Ensslin into suicide. It seems that that's a common MO that this room has in dealing with its victims. It's trying to set up a situation where the victim chooses to die. Towards the end, the voice of the hotel manager, which is really the demon, tells Ensslin that he has to choose to die or check out. Though, I'll be honest, the room reminds me of that line from Hotel California. You can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave. Considering that Stephen King tends to reference old songs rather a lot in his books, I actually would not be surprised if that was a deliberate reference.
First of all, you get a point of inspiration for the Eagles reference. That was perfect. Mike does end up stuck in that room, even if it's his version of heaven. The wood of suicide seems to be a recurring thing. I think you're right about that. I want to go as far as that leading into your thing about Mike already being dead, but it just doesn't quite fit. 12 suicides in one room is a lot, though. But if I could bust out with another theory I have about 1408, Mike doesn't believe in anything, and he is lost in the pain and guilt of his past. Every time he tries to see a little light, maybe a way out, his guilt and his pain come up again, and he can't see past it. And Mike Ensslin is morose and wallows in his own funk, according to his publisher, and has a generally solemn attitude. It's like he is dead inside. I think that dead guy with his eyes covered in the maze of air ducts was Mike Ensslin. I think Mike Ensslin knew that too when he saw the dead man with his legs that don't work come alive and look at him. That's why he yelled, "I can't help you," as he turned and tried to run and get out of the maze to escape the version of himself that frightened him so much. I also wonder if seeing himself like that reminded him of his father and his father's words, "As you are, I was. As I am, you will be." And that cruel smile that he had when he said it. In Olin's own words, he thought the father character in The Long Run Home was a real bastard. I noticed that The Long Road Home could be a play on John Milton's Long is the Way and Hard That Out of Hell Leads Up to Light from Paradise Lost. From the perspective of Lucifer, his dad was certainly a bastard. I think he speaks of Mike knowing it is a long, hard road ahead of him if he is going to climb out of the hell he is in and into the light. His fear of that long road home is what the room is playing on.
That makes sense. I think when you mentioned that Enslin is dead inside, that sounds right to me, actually. I think everything good in him died with Katie, and that loss killed him spiritually. So he's just going through the motions ever since, trying not to deal with the pain. Mainly it's with his job and the hotel trips, but I think it's implied he also does this with alcohol. Again, the alcoholic writer is a major Stephen King trope, so it's probably deliberate. Nice catch with the Milton line, too, and it may be that Milton was on his mind as well. But I think he's also dealing with another recurring King idea, the concept that the sons repeat the mistakes of their fathers. This was something King brought up in Dr. Sleep with Danny Torrance, and I think we see it again here. In this case, I think the reason Enslin's father is trying so hard to get through to him in the flashback is because he knows how that ends. He's trying to break the cycle, but Enslin throws it back in his face and just leaves him in the nursing home with nothing but half-remembered regrets. It's not until Enslin gets over himself that he tries to make amends with his father, and that's when it truly breaks the cycle. But speaking of parents and children, I think you had another observation in mind.
I do, but first, I mean, that is a bit of an eye-opener, actually. I knew that Mike's father was trying to talk some sense into Mike after Katie died, but I didn't connect it with the sins of the father, which actually sheds more light on what his father meant by saying, what you are, I was. What I am, you will be. Great observation there, Steve. You're knocking it out of the park today. But you guessed it. I have yet another theory based on a little fact. In the film, Katie asks her mother, why is the Bible purple? Purple is the traditional color for adapted children's Bibles, most notably the English Standard Version Children's Bible, which has been in print for years and continues to have new editions released. There is no specific reason why this color was chosen for the children's Bibles. However, it is worth noting that the Bible they had was a children's Bible, meaning the faith, the hope, the light they were attempting to instill in Katie was solely for Katie. That was something the Enslin did to help their daughter. That was something the Enslins did to help their daughter. But they themselves did not believe it. That is the impression I got anyway. That's why Mike was so angry that they had done that. He believed that, as he said to Olin, that there is no God to protect us. So he felt like he gave his daughter false hope. They should have actually better prepared her for what she had to face. But I got the impression that regardless of what her parents were telling her, she knew very well that she was going to die, and I think she was prepared for it.
Enslin doesn't really understand that what they did wasn't a bad thing, and in fact, they probably made Katie's death more bearable for her. What they did was offer hope and comfort that what lies on the other side might be better and free of pain. But because Enslin is wrapped up in his own pain and grief, he takes the wrong lesson from it, concluding that it's better to tell hard, painful truths than to try to comfort people with faith. And it's here that I think I finally understand why Enslin stopped telling stories and just stuck to these hotel review books. Because the act of telling stories is crafting a comfortable life for the reader. And I don't mean that in the sense that we're trying to deceive people, even though there is that phrase about writers being liars. The idea is that there is hope, a light at the end of the tunnel, and a just methodology behind the world that we understand. That's what we create as writers. I think that after Katie's death, Enslin just couldn't do that anymore. So he stopped writing stories and instead dove into these books meant to debunk the supernatural. We see later that because of his experiences fighting the room, that during the LA scenes, he's able to work through his trauma and finally write a work of fiction again. He starts to realize that hope and faith does have the power to help people's lives, and that's an important part of his journey.
I can agree with that. I had not considered why he said the man who wrote The Wrong Road Home was a different person. But it's pretty obvious now. Building on what you said, it's as if Mike lost his way and himself. And at least in that version of the film, he finds himself again. Not just as a person, but as a writer. Like you said, he had reinvented himself.
Yeah, right. It's definitely the story of a man reclaiming and rediscovering a part of himself that he had lost. But it's also the story that resonates deeply because it hits this powerful emotional chord.
It really does, and I just got to say that this movie really hits home for me. I had a son that died at 6 months old of SIDS, and my family broke up because of it. So a child dying always gets me right in the feels, and I understand why the family would split apart. Also, the last time I saw my daughter, she was 8 years old, right around Katie's age in the film. So this hits home right there, too. Granted, these similarities are nowhere near exact situations, but I do know the feeling of losing a child, and that is a wound that never heals. I think that is one of the big reasons I picked this film to cover here. This is a horror movie that taps into my personal fears and pains. So empathizing with Mike Ensland is very easy for me. And when you can get drawn into a film like that, it makes it all the better, even when it hurts.
That totally makes sense. I won't pretend to understand what it means to be a parent. So I can't say that it hit me in the same way. The closest I can imagine is to think of losing one of my nephews. But since King is a father, one of his sons is actually the writer Joe Hill. He knows how to hit that primal parental fear, and that's probably why the impact of this story is as strong as it is.
Definitely. Being a parent totally makes King know exactly what buttons to push for a parent. And actually, speaking of being a parent, I think that The Room took it too far with having Katie appear to him in the flesh at the end. The pain was pushed so far in that moment that it turned into absolute rage. I know that if someone did that to me about my children, the fury of seven hells would be unleashed for me. His despair became boiling, burning hatred for that room. I think Mike Ensland burned that room down out of furious, righteous vengeance.
Understandably so. I will say that I wasn't certain if that really was the spirit of Katie or if it was a memory that the room plucked out of his head. But either way, I agree that the room overplayed its hand on that one. The room seems to like giving bits of hope to make the despair hit harder. To be fair, sometimes it works. But by using Katie as bait, it just pushed Ensland too far. Ensland just stopped caring if he lived or died, and he may even have hoped that he'd see the real Katie in the afterlife. I think that's probably true of at least one of the endings, but we'll get into that before long, I'm sure.
That we will, Steve. But to switch gears here to a less depressing note, I think we should discuss the number 13 in this film, as it is a regularly occurring number throughout the film. Now, as far as the real world goes, it is only superstition that claims 13 is an evil or unlucky number. But superstition or not, there is a medical condition called caducophobia, that is the fear of the number 13. People with this condition attempt to avoid bad luck by avoiding anything labeled or numbered 13. As a result of this condition, there are companies and manufacturers that go out of their way not to use the number, and that is why you get buildings that don't have a 13th floor, much like the dolphin. But there are several cultures that actually consider 13 a lucky number, but we're going to focus on the bad stuff here. The end of the Mayan calendar's 13 Bactun was believed to be the harbinger of the apocalypse craze of 2012 when the Bactu ended. Because there were 13 people at the Last Supper, including Yeshua, and Judas Iscariot is considered to be the 13th one who sat at the table, it is also considered unlucky to have 13 guests at a table. Friday the 13th has been considered an unlucky day since Friday the 13th of October in 1307, when King Philip IV of France ordered the arrest of the Knights Templar, and most of the knights were tortured and killed. They literally went around from city to city and dragged them out. Really, it could be all of these things or none of them. According to my research, there is no definitive source for the number 13 being evil or unlucky. The point should be, though, that for the sake of this film, 13 is an evil fucking number, if I may paraphrase Mr. Olin. You will also note that the writer of The Shining threw in a 13 with the height of the walls of the maze.
Yeah, and I will throw this out for you. John Cusack was in a movie that referenced the Mayan apocalypse 2012. So I'm just kind of throwing it out there. Anyway, 13 is a number that has significance for sure. And I think you went over it pretty well. And like you said, this is the reason why there's no 13th floor in the Dolphin Hotel, which again was influenced by the Emily Morgan Hotel's decision not to invite superstition by using that number. But I think you had more to add on that.
There is a bit more about that, actually. There are many references to the number 13 that I have been able to track down. Number one is the name Michael Ensland. It has 13 letters in it. And the Dolphin Hotel is at 2254 Lexington in New York. And 2254 equals 13. The room itself is on the 13th floor, and 1408 adds up to 13. Kevin O'Malley committed suicide in the room by slashing his own throat back in 1912, and 1912 equals 13. The room's key has 6214 etched into it, and that equals 13. The post office worker mentions 148 to the person he's getting the mail for, which adds up to 13. And to double down on that moment, he says that in exactly 1 hour, 22 minutes, and 35 seconds, which also adds up to 13. There are more, and I invite you to track them down. It will baffle you how many times it comes up. But I will end with this. The room's thermostat model is written on the lower right, and it says SUK3073, and 3073 equals 13.2. What are your thoughts on all of that 13 stuff, Steve?
Well, before I answer, I just want to add one more 1408 reference. When Enslin wakes up on the beach in L.A., the plane flying overhead has a flag trailing behind it that reads, "One low fee, 1408. Numbers are carefully dropped throughout the film, as we've shown, and I think they managed to do it very discreetly and cleverly. You never really notice them too closely on a first watch, but they do stand out when you rewatch it. And I think that's consistent with the Stephen King experience. King has said that he likes to reward the rereading of his books, and that was something that he took away from Lord of the Flies, a book that he enjoyed when he was younger. And apparently that's true of this film as well.
You know, I do remember King talking about that, actually. He was saying, having gone through the book the first time, he was obsessed with finding out whether or not Ralph lived or not. But knowing the end, he was able to pick up new things along the way that made the book even better. I will tell you that rereading books and comics and rewatching movies and shows is a practice I do myself, and I can guarantee the eye-opening quality of this practice. When you're watching or reading something again, as King put it, your analytical mind kicks in. In fact, that's where I get a lot of this stuff for these episodes. But now we need to talk about the endings to 1408. There are four endings to this film. There's the theatrical cut, where Mike survives and reconciles with Lily, but she does not believe in his experience. That is until Mike plays back the tape and she hears Katie's voice on the tape, and Mike gives her a look like, "Do you believe me now?" But also a little hurt in his eyes that she doubted him in the first place. An alternative version of this ending has the exact same events, but Lily does not acknowledge hearing Katie's voice on the tape, and only Mike's reaction is shown. The third version is the director's cut, which was shot because of the original and fourth ending of the story was deemed a downer ending. Mike dies in the fire, and he is happy to do it, knowing that the room will be destroyed. The room itself screams in agony as the fire consumes it, and everything begins to crash down on Mike. At Mike's funeral, Olin approaches Lily and Mike's publisher, Sam Farrell. He unsuccessfully attempts to give her the box of Mike's possessions, including the tape recorder. Olin claims that the room was successfully destroyed and it will no longer hurt anybody else. He later listens to the recording in his car and becomes upset when he hears Katie's voice on the tape. He sees a little girl in a dress walking in the cemetery grass behind the car, calling out as if she is lost. He then sees Mike's burnt corpse in the back seat. Then he sees the same little girl holding hands with her father as they walk away. Olin places the tape recorder back in the box and drives off. The final scene is of the gutted room, where the apparition of Mike assesses the death of the entity while smoking a cigarette. He hears his daughter calling for him, and he disappears as he walks off towards the door. The door is heard closing and the scene fades, indicating in death Mike has freed all of the souls. The original version cut the funeral scene and dubbed it over with shots of Los Angeles and Lily and Sam sorting through Mike's stuff. Sam returns to his New York office and discovers the manuscript that Mike wrote while he was in room 1408, which is a little weird for me. I don't know how he would have written a script in that room. As Sam reads the story, audio from Mike's experience in the room is heard. In a final scene, Sam's office door slams shut, and Mike's father's voice says, "As you are, I was. As I am, you will be." So what do you think, Steve? Do you have a preference now that you've heard about the book and the different endings of the film? What is your favorite version?
Well, I've watched a couple of versions of this film, including the theatrical version and the director's cut. I've also seen the alternate endings that are on YouTube. I personally prefer the idea that Enslin died in burning the room down, as that's both believable and consistent with the Dante connection that they're going with. To me, it makes sense that that journey ends with Dante finally reuniting with Beatrice, which in this case means that Enslin is reunited with his daughter. I feel like him dying just makes that act one of love, redemption, and sacrifice. He's gone through hell and purgatory, and he earns a way into heaven because he destroyed the evil room and freed the lost spirits in the hotel. I didn't care so much about the theatrical ending because I just think the power of his sacrifice doesn't have as much weight if he survives it. I will say as an aside that I like the idea of the publisher receiving the last manuscript that Ensslin wrote in the mail. It's inexplicable as to how this would happen, but I think it's more emotionally satisfying that that last story that represents Ensslin's personal transformation is allowed to be read. But how about you, Mike?
Well, I'm a little torn about it, actually. On the one hand, the theatrical cut is closer to King's story, and so I feel like I should respect that. At the same time, I totally agree with you. I think Mike definitely needed to die in the hotel. But I tend to believe, as I mentioned earlier, that Mike burned it down out of hatred for the room. But in that hate, I can see a bit of a hope you're talking about with him seeing Katie in the afterlife. It can also be that he did give his life and the axe set the others free, and maybe that was what finally brought him out of purgatory. But let's get into our final thoughts on the film. I have to put 1408 up there with my favorite horror movies, like a top 10. It is definitely my favorite haunted hotel movie. This movie has layers and layers to dissect, as our listeners surely know or have discovered on the show. I am personally really impressed with John Cusack, and I would rank him up there with like Joaquin Phoenix as far as acting ability. In fact, Cusack and Phoenix have a very similar style. Well, they will do an entirely different performance on each take. Not to mention that he has been in a variety of different roles. That dude has some serious range. But what about you, Steve? What are your final thoughts on 1408?
I think the 1408 is a really good psychological horror, which is my favorite kind. The story reaches into the main character's head, calls him out on all of his flaws, trying to break him. But instead, he learns from his mistakes and all of the wrong he's done. He works through his trauma, and he's able to use it to make a great heroic sacrifice. I really dig stories like that, and I think that both John Cusack and Samuel L. Jackson are both really great in this film. I'll also make a side note that We've Only Just Begun is an interesting song to use in 1408. One of my favorite films is In the Mouth of Madness by John Carpenter, which we've discussed in a previous episode. But the interesting thing to bring up here is that movie is inspired very loosely by Stephen King. Sutter Kane is based in part on King. Also, King is a good friend of John Carpenter, who adapted his novel Christine. So I honestly would not be surprised if the filmmakers were aware of that, or if King himself planted the song in the book. I just find it really cool that King and Carpenter connected the use of that one song. And the song was made by a band called The Carpenters, which In the Mouth of Madness makes a joking reference at. Not The Carpenters, indeed.
That is pretty cool. And actually, I hope it was on purpose. That would be awesome. But we still have a whole other movie to talk about. So it's about time we switch over to our next film. I found a couple of references to The Shining in 1408, believe it or not. So I thought that might make a perfect bridge. One of the first victims in the room was named Grady. Charles and Delbert Grady were caretakers of the Overlook Hotel in The Shining back in the 70s before Jack and his family arrived there. Granted, Grady Miller in 1408 drowned in a bowl of his own chicken soup, but I think the name reference is solid. The Shining is also another story written by Stephen King that takes place in a hotel. There's more references to the movie as well. I think that when Ensslin asked, where are the rivers of blood about the room, that was definitely a reference to The Shining. Shining as well.
Oh yes, indeed, that was a Shining reference. 1408 does take cues from The Shining or make subtle references to it, like the instances that you mentioned. And like The Dolphin, the Overlook Hotel was based on a real haunted hotel, the Stanley Hotel in Estes Park, Colorado. In fact, they had to change one of the room numbers they used in the film to an unused number because they didn't want room 237 to be associated with the Stanley Hotel.
That is funny. I mean, what would be wrong with people coming to their hotel for that reason? It could be a whole other means of revenue. But on the flip side of that, I guess I can understand if you're exclusively catering to the upper class. I mean, you don't want the poor mingling with the rich. Now it might traumatize the wealthy. But seriously, why don't we talk about The Shining, Steve?
Sure. I wanted to talk about The Shining because it's one of the first films that really got me into horror more seriously. I'm a huge fan of Stanley Kubrick, who I mainly got into because of 2001: A Space Odyssey. I'm a huge fan of that film. So watching his other films made sense as a starting point. But The Shining is a film that I rewatch every so often. It's just an extremely well-shot film. The musical score is haunting, and Jack Nicholson's performance is iconic in this movie. Now, there are differences of opinion between King and Kubrick, enough that King nowadays tends to disavow this version of The Shining. But personally, I really enjoy this movie for what it is, and there's an unsettling creep factor about this film that's hard to define and even harder to replicate. So let's start with the character of Danny Torrance. He's a character that gets fleshed out more in Dr. Sleep, the sequel, where Danny is an adult and we see what he becomes. That's a good movie, and I recommend it if you're a fan of The Shining. But in this film, he's a classic Stephen King psychic child and someone who is also troubled because of his father's alcoholism and physical abuse. And these things are bad enough even when you don't have psychic powers. But it is low-key the center of a lot of what we see going on in this movie. What did you make of Danny, Mike?
Well, it is my opinion that Danny has either schizophrenia or DID, mostly because of his Tony personality, although his memory issues and decreased participation in daily activities make me want to lean into the schizophrenic idea. But at the same time, I must confess that DID is a possibility as Tony full-on takes over when Danny hides within himself. It seems like Danny has compartmentalized the Shining ability into the Tony character, and that has a very DID-like slant to it. But you'll notice how Danny didn't want to tell the doctor about whether or not Tony ever tells him to do things. I have a schizophrenic friend, and she told me that the voices she hears often puts her down and tells her to do things that are out of character for her to do. Anyway, that is a vibe that I picked up from Danny in that scene. My friend often doesn't want to talk about the voices she hears and the things she sees. She does so to avoid the stigmas of being labeled insane. You know, once that label is put on you, anything you say or do is just immediately disregarded as nonsense, no matter how real it is for you. It scares me to think that back in 1980s, things like auto-hypnosis were the prevailing theories about these mental health issues. But at the same time, there is some element to it that is just a kid trying to make sense of his abilities and using his imagination to fill in the rest. You know, I think like Tony being a boy that lives in his mouth and hides in his stomach. That totally sounds like something a little kid would make up.
I can totally see why you'd think that, and I did have moments where I wondered if DID was a problem myself, especially after spending a couple of episodes talking about Moon Knight. There are valid reasons to suspect that may have happened. Childhood abuse and trauma is often involved with the onset of DID, and Danny was a victim of his father's drunken rages. Also an interesting fact, Anthony is Danny's middle name, so Tony would make sense as the name of an alter. So it is possible that Tony could be an alter that Danny created to process his internal trauma. At the same time, I'm not certain it's quite that simple. Danny does have psychic abilities, and it could be possible that Tony is some kind of a spiritual guide for Danny. It's entirely possible that Tony is a real being that is separate from Danny with complete autonomy, who is posing as an imaginary friend. Or it could be a mundane thing based on a child's imagination as a way of coping with a power that he hasn't fully learned to understand or control. It could be that the reason Danny decides to keep his power a secret is that he doesn't think that anyone would understand what he could do, or worse, write it off as a mental illness. It's hard to nail down how much of Danny's behavior is real-world psychology at work and how much is Danny's power manifesting in a way that we don't fully grasp.
You know, you make a good point, actually. It's quite possible that they didn't even have psychology in mind at all. If it was, it might have been just loosely based. That Danny is a kid struggling to make sense of his abilities seems to fit the story better, save for but a couple of things. But I will get into those later. I have my doubts that the dislocation of Danny's shoulder by his father when he was drunk caused a split in Danny's identity. That just doesn't fit with the disorder. But I think this is filled out a bit more in the 1977 novel and might suggest both spousal and child abuse on the part of Jack. Jack is a recovering alcoholic in both the film and the book, but his anger issues aren't made apparent right away. But in the book, Jack's anger caused him to accidentally break Danny's arm, not dislocate his shoulder, and lose a teaching job after assaulting a student. That paints a whole other picture of Jack. He was volatile long before he ever got to that motel. One thing that seems to change in the film is that Jack's reasoning for going to the hotel seems to be entirely selfish. He wanted time alone to write, probably hoping that maybe a change of location might inspire him. I don't know, but Jack didn't sound too convincing when he told his new boss that his wife and his son would enjoy the isolation or the locale. It really seemed like a secondary concern that was not very important. In fact, even when Danny's safety and health are involved, Jack blamed Wimdy for making up the whole situation and says that he's not going to let her fuck up his chance to work. Not now when he's really into it. Which turns out to only be writing all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy over and over again for like 500 pages. Whereas in the novel, Jack actually hopes that the hotel's seclusion will help him reconnect with Danny and his wife, Wendy, and give him the motivation needed to work on the play.
Jack was always really screwed up, though it should be said that the movie makes him out to be more volatile than he may have actually been. Jack Nicholson's performance is creepy even from the start, which goes against a bit farther than he does in the book. In fact, Stephen King was against casting Jack Nicholson because he didn't seem normal enough before he goes off the rails. To be fair, though, Nicholson sells the transformation, and his performance as the unhinged Jack is brilliant. But I get where King was coming from with his objections. That said, I would agree that Jack is a case where the hotel brought out the darkness that he brought in with him. He had a severe alcohol problem and anger management issues, and I get the feeling they were so severe that Jack felt he had to start over elsewhere. In an argument with Wendy, he talks about his only other options being mundane jobs, and I can't help but think that it's because he burned his bridges elsewhere because of his drunken behavior and his anger problems. But where it really goes wrong is that Jack is so driven to keep his job at the Overlook at any cost that he's willing to hurt his wife and child, and then he falls off the wagon, starts drinking again, and I'm sure the extreme cabin fever didn't help either. So Jack was always a broken mess, and he might have turned out horribly regardless, but the evil spirits and the isolation probably put him over the edge. There may have been some good in him, but that's gone after he's consumed by the evil in the hotel and his own demons.
Once again, I think you have a clearer picture than I do with that. I had not connected all those dots that way, but it makes a lot of sense. I'd like to talk about the ability called The Shining, if we could. The Shining is not specifically defined in the movie, although it is hinted at. But in the book, we find that The Shining includes reading minds, like Danny is able to do with both Dick Halloran and his father. There are also premonitions, or the ability to sense imminent danger, like Danny, or rather Tony, was able to do about going to the Overlook Motel. The Shining also includes clairvoyance, or the ability to see the future, like Danny's visions about what would happen there. Both in the movie and in the book, Danny forms a bond with Dick Halloran, who also has The Shining. In the movie, Dick talks about how some people have The Shining and some people don't, just like how some places have The Shining and some places don't, implying that there is already a psychic energy or The Shining in the hotel. What's interesting about Danny's abilities is that in the book and in the movie, he does not ever tell his parents about it, even after he starts seeing terrifying visions. They were bad, too. Danny straight checked out for a while. In the book, it says that Danny sensed that the caretaking job at the Overlook Hotel was important to Jack and even convinced his mom not to abandon him at the hotel. However, there is, as we've discussed, a supernatural element to the hotel, and Danny soon realizes that his very presence there actually amplifies it by turning the echoes of the past already in the Overlook into very solid and dangerous threats. What's more is that the hotel is trying to possess Danny like a demon would, something also akin to 1408. The snowstorm totally isolates the family and cuts them off from the outside world.
We see the answer to some of this in Dr. Sleep, where we see other people with The Shining. Different people have different abilities that manifest with The Shining, and it doesn't work for everyone the exact same way. As for Danny's decision not to tell his parents, honestly, I don't blame him, given that Jack definitely wouldn't have understood, and I'm not sure even Wendy would have been able to cope with it that easily. As it is, it's hard to be sure how much of Danny's behavior is childhood trauma, and how much of it is that he has a unique gift, and he could easily have been mislabeled. But as Dick Halloran says, the Overlook Hotel is a place of powerful negative energy because of the terrible things that people have left behind there. The film version also suggests that because the Overlook was built on a Native American burial ground, that it was already a place of negative spiritual energy, even before the hotel was built over it. The combination of Danny's power and the concentrated evil in the hotel in one place was bound to lead to bad outcomes.
Wow, you know, I was going to ask if that was like a Poltergeist thing, but The Shining came out 2 years before Poltergeist. So I guess Poltergeist might have done a Shining thing. In the book, the hotel has an actual spirit of evil possessing it, or something like that. The book refers to it as the hotel did this, or the hotel did that. So I think the hotel really was the amalgamation of a few types of evil. But when the hotel cannot possess Danny, who wants it for his abilities, it goes after Jack in the book. Whereas in the movie, the hotel was after Jack from day one. And that actually leads into a theory I have come across. But let me preface this with a quote from the guy who made the movie. In an interview, Stanley Kubrick said that the photograph suggests Jack was the reincarnation of an earlier official at the hotel. So Charles Grady could have been the reincarnation of Delbert Grady, thus why he killed his family. Jack Torrance then went through the same experience as Charles Grady in terms of being the reincarnation of one of the overlooked sinister presences. But luckily for Wendy and Danny, Jack didn't kill his family as Grady did. I originally thought that Mr. Lloyd is the hotel's avatar, its voice. It's devil on Jack Torrance's shoulder, if you know what I mean. But he's not the only one. There is a Delbert Grady, the butler, that all but says what Mr. Lloyd only hinted at, that Jack needs to kill his family, and that is what the hotel has wanted all along. This, I think, is another thing that was carried over into 1408, actually. The receptionist that keeps calling Mike on the phone could be the room's avatar. But while we're on the subject of the Gradys, I want to say that I'm going with Kubrick on what happened there. The Overlook Hotel recycles its victims, aka the caretakers, by way of reincarnation. And those victims in turn take the lives of their family. And in the case of the movie, even Mr. Holleran. The key is the Gradys. Jack Torrance himself, and the big clue is obviously the photo from 1921, where we see Jack as the caretaker of the hotel at the front of the picture. Delbert Grady described killing his family in so many words, and most notably with an axe. And of course, Charles Grady kills his family with an axe. That sounds like reincarnation to me. Then, of course, Delbert Grady's line, "Jack has always been the caretaker," which I think might suggest that the original caretaker in the photo might have started all this, and it is his echo that takes possession of the caretakers. I say this because Jack Torrance was dark and a bit unhinged when he arrived at the hotel, and you have to assume his past self was the same way.
I think the whole idea of Jack having been previously at the hotel was an invention of Kubrick, though it is an interesting one that sheds light on the hotel motivation a bit. Now that I think about it, it explains how Jack knew Lloyd's name after just meeting him. It was a residual memory from a previous life. Note, Lloyd never at any point introduces himself, and the two of them act like they're old friends, so that tracks. Anyway, this suggests a cycle of violence that ends in death, which then repeats after death, and possibly rebirth. This further lends credence to the idea that Jack was always predisposed to descending into madness and violence. If so, that also suggests the possibility that the hotel has had an influence on Jack for far longer than just his time at the Overlook that we saw. It could even be that the hotel may have been influencing people like Ullman into bringing Jack on, which would also explain some things. It goes back to the idea that these evil hotels like to repeat patterns, particularly patterns related to death and violence. And Jack is the one who maintains that pattern, giving the hotel more blood and death to feed on. So he is the caretaker, just not in watching over the place, but also feeding the evil in the hotel.
You know, that is a very cool way to look at it. And at least for me, makes me want to choose that it was the hotel that sent the postcard in 1408. So that we're clear on that now. I like this idea, and I think the correlation makes it fun for me. But I want to talk about Jack for just a second. Jack seems to be having an enormous case of writer's block, and it would seem to me that he's trying to force his creativity, which, for me at least, is always a bad move. He doesn't seem to be beholden to a deadline from a publisher, so I'm not sure what all the frustration and anger is about. The one thing I can think of is that perhaps he is just frustrated because being a writer is not as easy and immediately lucrative as he may have imagined in his mind. But that is from the perspective of a somewhat rational mind. And we know that Jack was being changed and corrupted by the evil hotel.
Right. It could be that some of the problem was made worse by the cabin fever and the isolation. But still, that is hard to fathom. Usually if I'm blocked, I work on something else. But in Jack's case, I think it goes back to his anger issues and his suppressed desire to drink again. King intended the story as a metaphor for alcoholism, and alcohol impairs the ability to think clearly. So it could have been related to that idea, though I'm not a hard drinker, so I can't say for sure if that's what King intended or not.
I think that totally makes sense. In fact, it seems to shed some light on the all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy over and over again thing. Jack said he would give his soul for just a beer. He's talking about all of these responsibilities that he has, and I'm guessing that the play he was referring to was drinking. I'm definitely seeing the alcoholism theme here. But I do have a bit more to discuss as far as Jack Torrance is concerned, though. Okay, so Jack Nicholson has one of those faces that does not have to do too much to look wild and crazy, especially when he lifts his eyebrows. It just looks freaky. So I'm sure that that had something to do with it. But seeing the twins murdered in the hallway and asking Danny to come play with him again forever and ever was definitely creepy. But that was just a setup for an even creepier scene of seeing the insomniac Jack sitting on the bed with a sort of manic yet exhausted look on his face. Danny acts like he's afraid of Jack as he approaches his father. Then Jack tells Danny that he wishes they could stay at the hotel forever and ever, and it gets really unsettling. But both the viewer and Danny's mind go directly to the bloody corpses of the twins and their words to Danny. So, of course, Danny asks if Jack would ever hurt him or Mommy, which tells me at least that Tony has told Danny about Charles Grady. And having seen the twins, he fears now that Jack might be going down that same road.
Very possible. And that scene did stand out to me as well on my last rewatch of it. I get the feeling that they were trying to show him some humanity in Jack before he loses what's left of his mind. Jack clearly has regrets about what he's being tempted into, and he does genuinely love his son, but he doesn't have the strength within him to turn away from the evil spirits, either the ones in the bottle or the ones in the hotel. Because of that, and Nicholson just being generally creepy looking as Jack, it does come across as a creepy moment rather than the last vestiges of a father who's just trying to hold on to his son.
Awesome. It would seem we are agreed on that. There's another thing about Jack that stood out to me. Jack's dream about killing his family and chopping them up into pieces reminds me a little bit about what happened to Michael Myers, hearing the voices and getting those visions when he was six that led to him killing his sister Judith. I think the Overlook Hotel is giving Jack visions, and he might be hearing voices as well. I'm not suggesting the Curse of Thorn thing, but rather the possibility that back in 1970, one of the Grady family likely had The Shining, and just like Danny is amplifying the hotel's shining, so too was someone in the Grady family. Basically, I think that what we're seeing happen to Jack is just like how it went down for Charles Grady in 1970 and Delbert Grady before that.
I agree that it's once again the hotel trying to relive the cycle of death and violence with the Gradys. I mean, I'm not sure if any of the Gradys had the ability to use The Shining, though it's possible that at least one of them did. Delbert Grady does seem to be concerned about people who can use this power, given his comments to Jack about Danny, and then the fact that he saw Halloran as a threat. But either way, it's clear that the death of the Gradys fed the evil in the hotel, and Jack is also wrapped up in that cycle.
Cool. Same page then. But I'd like to switch back over to the book and film comparison. One other thing that changed from the book was Delbert Grady's order to Jack when he was locked in the pantry. In the movie, Delbert just wants the family killed. But in the book, Delbert wants Jack to bring him Danny and kill his wife. Also, when Jack gets out of the pantry, things go considerably different in the book. In the book, the topiary animals, or shrubs made to look like animals, come alive and become a major threat. Jack attacks Wendy with one of the hotel's rope mallets, seriously injuring her, but she escapes to the caretaker's suite and locks herself in the bathroom. Jack attempts to break the door down with the mallet, but Wendy slashes his hand with a razor blade to deter him. Meanwhile, Halloran, having received a psychic distress call from Danny while working at the winter resort in Florida, rushes back to the Overlook, only to be attacked by the topiary animals and severely injured by Jack. But here is where things really deviate from the book. Jack pursues Danny through the hotel and corners him on the top floor, and for a brief moment, Jack takes control of himself again and begs Danny to run. The hotel quickly retakes control of Jack, making him violently batter his face and skull until it's unrecognizable with the mallet. This, of course, takes Jack out of the equation. It's just the hotel that has control of Jack's body now. Remembering that Jack has neglected to relieve the pressure on the hotel's unstable boiler, Danny informs the hotel in Jack's body that it is about to explode. As Danny, Wendy, and Halloran flee, the hotel Jack rushes to the basement in an attempt to vent the pressure, but it's too late. The boiler explodes, killing Jack and destroying the Overlook. Fighting off a last and desperate attempt by the hotel to possess him, Halloran guides Danny and Wendy to safety. This was way less dramatic in the film and mostly involved a lot of running and chasing, but never reaching each other. Dick does come to the Overlook, and it could certainly be interpreted that it was the result of the psychic message sent to him by Danny. There is no maze in the hotel in the book. Its main purpose seems to be to provide a way for Danny to meet back up with his mother, Wendy, and escape in the Snowcat while Jack froze to death. I'm sure you've got a few things to say about the movie versus book endings here, Steve. Do you have a preference between the two?
I'll be honest, I lean somewhat towards the book, at least in the sense that Jack was able to give his life to save his son, much as Mike Enslin sacrifices himself for his daughter in one of the 1408 endings. It shows that Jack is not doomed to go through this cycle again and again, and he can make the choice to save himself. I also didn't like Halloran dying the way he does in this movie. I felt like the death was there to make Jack more of a threat, but it wasn't a good way for Halloran to go out. I think he deserved better. At the same time, I do like the way the film plays out with Jack chasing Danny through the hedge maze. It's a suspenseful and it works. I don't think either version is bad. I just think that the King's was a bit more satisfying. As an aside, some elements of this ending do come up in Dr. Sleep. At the end of that movie, grown-up Danny decides to go to the Overlook to set up a trap for a group of evil psychics. At the end of the movie, Danny blows up the Overlook Hotel with a boiler in the same way as King's original ending of The Shining. So we did get that ending in a way, even if it took a few decades to finally get there.
That's pretty cool. And I think I like the book better as well. I also think I'm going to have to watch me some Dr. Sleep. But let's get into our final thoughts here. So I will admit that I saw some of The Shining as a kid and never felt the need to go back to it. I remember thinking that it was so long, and honestly, that was a big reason why I never came back to the film. But after watching the film for this episode, I see now that I wasn't really old enough to absorb all the things that I was seeing and therefore missed all of the nuance and layers. It's interesting, though, that King's two really big haunted hotel movies has so much depth to them. Even if things changed from the book, the layers stayed in there for the most part. I can't honestly say that The Shining is one that I need to own, but I'm really glad that I watched it a few times for this episode. How about you, Steve? Did you have any final thoughts on The Shining before we wrap up?
The Shining is a horror classic, and I think it's worth watching, even if it deviates from what King wrote. If nothing else, it is a beautiful film, and Kubrick really knows how to frame a scene. Some of the additions are interesting twists on the formula, but I do think that Kubrick kept enough of the core of the novel that it maintains its themes and characters decently well. There are some areas where the novel is probably still better, like Wendy's character or the ending of the film, but what Kubrick brings is a wonderful visual imagination and an unsettling vision of what this evil hotel is. It's a film that I have to come back to from time to time, especially around Halloween.
Awesome. You know, I love rewatching old horror movies around Halloween too. But that about wraps up our Stephen King's Haunted Hotels episode. I hope that you've had fun hanging out with us. I know that I've had a lot of fun digging into these films with Steve. I hope you'll come back in a couple of weeks when we dive into Predator 1 and 2 as well as the comics. Until then, I would like to thank our patrons who make this podcast possible.
I hope you've had fun hanging out with us today on ORP. I know that Steve and I have had fun making this episode. If you've had fun too, we invite you to share this episode and help us get the word out.
For our Spotify listeners, we ask you to please rate our show as well. That can really help to grow our audience. But to all our listeners everywhere, we want to say thank you for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.